Accession number 23327, Reel 3.
Mr. Carl Junger, Reel 3.
We flew through that winter, and sometimes got lost in fog. And one night, I was walking home from Litchfield with a parcel of chips in my hands, and I heard an aircraft flying over, and I remember thinking, rather him than me. I got back to my room, and I was reading when Stuart Wood came in and said, "Did you hear that aircraft going over?" I said, "Yes, he must have been lost." And he said, "It was hell, and they crashed into a hill, and they're all dead." And that was my first, it was my first ever experience of someone dear to me dying, and it hit me pretty hard. I was to become used to it, of course, but Hal had been like a big brother to me. He was rather older. He was, I think, just 10 years older. I had started smoking cigarettes, having bought them in Puerto Rico or St. Thomas, and I was starting to smoke them quite heavily. And one day, Hal, who was a great pipe smoker, put a pipe and a packet of tobacco in my hand, and he said, "That'll do you less harm than those things." I smoked a pipe for 46 years after that, and I still have a pipe of Hal's that I used to tease him about. It was a rather large pipe, and I used to call it the Bunsen burner, and that's the one souvenir I have of him. Other than that, we crewed up. There were a group of Australian pilots who trained together.
What training unit were you in?
27 OTU it was. And these pilots started coming around. Some had rappelled up with some of our observers and navigators. For instance, Bill Nettle had become friendly with two pilots named Burgess and Keyser. Keyser was very, very fair haired, so he was known as Midnight. His real name was Vernon. And they obviously asked Bill to be their navigator, and they got the rest of their crew together. And at Bill Nettle's suggestion, they told two of their pilot friends named Bill Clegg and Russell Jones that they might find me a reasonable navigator. So they invited me, and then we picked up a wireless operator who was English, and a front gunner also who was English. Their names were Ken Mellows and George Houghton. George was about 31 or 32, married and had a small daughter, so he was by far the oldest. Now those pairs of pilots flew together for some time after, even after we got to the squadron, and Russ Jones and Bill Clegg just took it in turns to captain the crew. If anything, I think Bill was the better pilot. But anyway, I'm jumping ahead a bit. I left Litchfield, I think I was posted on the 7th of February, if I remember. I was on leave with my then girlfriend's family, and I got a telegram posting me originally to Marham, which is an RAF station, but then that was rescinded, and I was told to report to 460 Squadron, which was just forming. I met Russ Jones and Bill Clegg in London, and we went to Molesworth, where the squadron had been formed, only to find that it had left Molesworth and had gone to Yorkshire to a place called Breeton, which was a satellite of Home on Spalding Moor, which was a well-known RAF station. Bill Nettle and Stuart Wood and others had somehow learned of the transfer, and they hadn't gone to Molesworth, but Bill and Stuart were keeping a bed for me in a three-in-a-room. The airfield was really centred on a farm which was still working. What the Air Force had left to them, they were still working. And for several weeks, we just did cross-country flights. York was bombed one night. This was part of the Baedeker campaign, so-called because the Luftwaffe attacked tourist-type cities like Canterbury and York. We flew over York very low the next day to look at the damage. It was very sad to see. On another occasion, we flew very high. We got the Wellington up to 25,000 feet, which was quite something for a Wellington. And we tried flying without oxygen just to see the results. And I made a total mess of the navigation. We all experienced difficulties one way or another. So we knew the value of oxygen, and we always used it after 10,000 feet. After that. But we flew across the lakes, which were under snow, and they were a wonderful sight. and we flew back across the lakes again, very low, and that was a different but also wonderful sight. We did a number of cross countries, as of course we had at OTU, to various points around the coast. On one occasion we were doing infrared bombing near Hull, and we actually found ourselves flying with German bombers who were bombing Hull, so we cleared out of that fairly quickly. We had several experiences of fog. On one occasion we had gone as far as Anglesey, and the airfield there had its runway lights on, and after we set out for Litchfield, that I think it was then, it was OTU, not the squadron, we found thick fog underneath us. Our wireless had gone, so we decided to turn back to Valley, where we had seen the lights, and we got back, but the lights were off now. And we flew around several times. We were almost out of petrol. We were considering bailing out. And then I thought if we fired the colours of the day, that might work. So I fired the colours of the day, which changed every few hours. You would have, say, red and green in your very pistol, and then it might change to yellow and blue. And so I tried it, and the lights came on, and we landed, having almost bailed out, but we landed, and we were dead out of petrol. And we stayed at Valley for a day, and it was still foggy, so we were sent back to Litchfield by train from Holyhead. Having done a number of cross-country flights, just as we would have done from OTU. We lost one crew on a cross country, and that was the first squadron loss. On March the 12th, 1942, the squadron went operational. I didn't fly that night. They were mostly old hands, including the flight commanders. I can't remember the exact date. I've got a logbook somewhere. I can't remember the exact date of our first operation, but we flew with both B-29 Bill Clegg and Russ Jones for about six ops before they took Bill Clegg away and gave him his own crew. That, in fact, was the night a little later that I was shot down. In April, we were told that Russ and I were the best combination of pilot and navigator in the group. That was because we had brought some remarkably good photographs back. And I had found that the method we had been told to use didn't seem to work out, and I had varied it myself. The wireless officer or signals officer asked me if I would give a talk about air photography, and then he said, just go through it with me, how you your routine. So I told him, and he said, you can't do that. And I said, well, it works. He said, oh, well, I don't know how it works, but that, you can't give a talk about that. So that was the last we heard about it. We also had a remarkable fuel consumption level. We were using about 76 to 80 gallons an hour, and everybody else on the squadron was using over 100. We were going to a lot of hard work. Russ was a very conscientious person, and he wanted to save petrol. It was part of the war effort. And so he used the winds, and he climbed at certain times and descended at other times to get the advantage of the wind. It was a lot of hard work for me, but it worked. So we did two or three easy ops on Le Havre, and our first really big one was Essen, where we were coned in searchlights for quite some time. Our rear gunner, Godfrey Loder, counted 90 from his turret, and there were cones on either side of us, and we watched aircraft in those cones get blown out of them. Bill Clegg was standing in the Astrodome giving Russ Jones instructions, and he eventually picked just the right moment, told Russ to dive, and we got out of it. We went to Hamburg on the first night after our 6-day leave. Now, we were sent on operations the day we were going on leave, which wasn't usual, so we didn't get back until the early morning of the following day, and Godfrey and somebody else in the crew, I think George, decided that we were being done out of our leave by a day, and they didn't return to the squadron in time to go on the Hamburg raid. So we had substitutes on that flight. But had Godfrey gone on it, he would have not flown with us the night we were shot down, because he would have finished his tour, which he'd started on another squadron before being transferred to 460, which was an Australian squadron, and he was transferred because he was an Australian, and they were trying to make up the numbers. We did other operations, Rostock, which was incredible. We could see the fires 140 miles away, and you had to feel sorry. But on the whole, it was a very dispassionate job. You didn't really think that you might be killing people. You just had a job to do, and there were all sorts of people challenging you, trying to stop you. And you didn't really think about people underneath. And what's more, you didn't know. So to this day, I don't know whether I killed a single German or whether I killed several thousand. I simply don't know. We went to Mannheim and Stuttgart, and on one occasion, Russ, after jinking violently when we had a night fighter in the vicinity, set his compass red on blue, that is, the wrong way round. So instead of flying north, we were flying south. And Bill Clegg suddenly said, "The moon was that away before, and now it's that away." And so we then had to retrace our steps, but it was very difficult quite to work out just where we were. And when we crossed the coast, we were actually quite a few miles from where we should have been. Came the night of 29th of May 1942, exactly a year from my departure from Sydney. We were given a target of the Naomi Roan factory at Gennevilliers near Paris. We were four aircraft from our squadron, 12 Wellingtons altogether, were detailed to fly at 2,000 feet and try to set the target alight so that the heavy bombers coming over at 10,000 feet, which was much lower than normal anyway, could see where the target was. In other words, it was an early experiment for the Pathfinder Force, which came into being a few months later. We set off late at night. It was a brilliant moonlight night, and I had a premonition that night, people often did, and I suppose sometimes it didn't work out. When we flew over Northampton, which was where my wireless operator lived, I told him to go down to the bomb site and have a look at his hometown, which he did. I remember flying over Reading. The roofs were gleaming in the moonlight, never guessing that one day Reading would be not far from where I live now. And on to Paris. As we approached, we saw there was an enormous amount of tracer light flak and masses of searchlights. And this wasn't what we expected, and it wasn't what the RAF top brass had expected either, because the following night they were aiming to put 1,000 bombers over Cologne. They had to scrape them up from OTUs, and the last thing they wanted was to lose valuable experienced crews and operational aircraft. But the Germans knew we were coming. I learned that from a prisoner later who had been in hospital nearby, and the German staff had been gloating and saying that we were going to get a hot reception, and indeed they put guns on the hospital roof that day. Well, we started our bombing run. We stuck to our orders and flew in at 2,000 feet. It looked to be pretty suicidal. And almost at once, we were hit amidships, and the intercom was put out of action. Now, the skipper and I decided then that I would give him bombing instructions using little red and green lights that were in the bomb site for that purpose. And this all took place in a matter of seconds. And before I could make a move, one of the blue master searchlights pinned us like a butterfly. And a burst of red tracer set the starboard wing alight. It appeared actually to come through the nose of the aircraft, but it didn't. It sliced across the wing. I could hear the rear gunner firing down the beam of the searchlight, and the Germans admitted to him later that he had in fact killed 11 Germans. I put the skipper's parachute on his knee. His parachute and mine were contained in their sort of tin. They weren't boxes exactly, but containers anyway, just near the, really in the pilot's cockpit area, because that night we had no second pilot. Normally my parachute would have been further back in the aircraft. I then released the front gunner from his turret, handed him his parachute, and opened the hatch in the bomb site and told him to jump. Then I put my own chute on and helped the skipper fasten his, and he asked if there was any chance. And I looked out the window and saw this mass of flames, and I said no. We then went into a screaming dive, and it really was a scream. Like they do on the pictures, I always thought it was exaggerated, but it wasn't. Russ, my skipper, had a slight smile on his face. I knew he had no intention of jumping. I don't think he could have got out, but he didn't know what had happened to some of the crew, and he was not likely to jump without knowing that. Anyway,